Hi, everyone. I want to say thank you for taking time to listen to Shine Without Shame. If you enjoyed this episode or any others, please take a minute to rate my podcast on Spotify or Apple Podcasts and share any positive comments. I appreciate your support. Without further ado, my guest today is Oak Ritchie. Oak is an Afro-Caribbean Indigenous information scientist who currently works in Indigenous advocacy in Anchorage, Alaska. He lives at the intersection of people and how they use technology and loves to learn how people can be empowered by their heightened connection through tools available to them. Oak, thank you for joining me. I'm really excited.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Yes, I appreciated reflecting back on when our paths actually crossed. They didn't technically cross the first time I learned about you, but it was when I was working for a video production team, a newsreel team, and you were the subject of a story. And so I wasn't a part of that, producing that story, but I learned about you through the team when they brought back all the footage. And I was like, oh, this guy's cool. He's got a lot of ideas. He's really articulate. And so that must have been, gosh, that could have easily been, it's not quite 20 years, but 15, like 16, 17,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. At least. Mm-hmm. So, and I know we've sort of been loosely connected, you know, in ways online and through friends. So anyway, I'm so glad to have you here and to get to know you a little bit more and talk about a subject that means a lot to me and that I think people need to kind of think through and reflect on a bit more in terms of how they, what the relationship is with shame, how they relate to shame. Do they even know maybe if they're experiencing shame or holding on to it? And I started the podcast so there could be conversations about shame, what it is, how do we work through it, but also about shining. Even if we misstep or make mistakes, have challenges, deal with even trauma, how can we rise above it? I wanted to explore that and really offer our best selves to the world, acknowledging our gifts and contributions as something that is inherently a part of who we are, our nobility. We're meant to be who we are. We're meant to offer what we have in terms of our gifts and our qualities to the world. And we shouldn't feel badly about that, in my opinion. And I appreciate exploring this concept with people. And I thought I would start by asking you, what is your relationship with shame? Or have you thought about it? Have you, you know, examined how it comes up in your life or how you've been able to work through it, please? And share what your thoughts are about the idea of letting go of it, you know, releasing ourselves from shame.
For sure. Well, you know, I grew up in an Afro-Caribbean household that really had a lot of strong ties to, you know, its ancestry and, you know, but it's also kind of mixed in with, you know, being exposed to the byproducts, the cultural landscape that has this deep ancestral knowledge mixed with this colonized Christian kind of overlay that kind of happened, where a lot of things were kind of instilled in them to be shameful about what they believed, where their beliefs came from. So I kind of had an early education into like my background, looking at my grandparents, looking at how my parents reacted to my grandparents' experience, in recognizing that there is something very interesting about this concept of shame that seems to be linked to some degree, like an emanation of one's ego in context with judgment of others. So many of so my father's Haitian, and when a lot of Haitians move to the United States, they do everything they can to just immediately like assimilate, right? They assimilate, they lose their accent if they possibly can, they stop using their language, they don't necessarily, in previous generations, they didn't always teach their children their native language. So I know that, like, you know, there wasn't an emphasis on me learning French or Creole because, you know, it was very important that I speak English really well. And this is no shortcoming of my parents. It's just kind of a product of where they were. So there is a certain degree of shame, even in relationship to not being able to speak English, you know, in a way that is acceptable to the dominant culture here, which, you know, is going to be the colonized force is white folks. And that's white culture that essentially determines what is normal, what is the accepted, what is the ideal. And so everyone coming from another country trying to be successful here has to kind of figure out how to adhere and assimilate into that. So there's a shame kind of built into that that I had to deconstruct as I was growing up, as I was coming into my own, you know, because early on, you know, I didn't really speak Spanish around my friends. I didn't really, like, you know, I thought it was weird that, you know, we ate the rice and beans and boulettes the way we did at our house, and that, you know, maybe our house smelled like food when you came into it. You know, there's all these different things you hear people's stories about, you know, oh, you know, their house smelled like curry. You know what that, you know, and so that vibe, that sense of that's not normal, right, became something that I had to process as how do I think about shame. And so growing up and coming into my own, I really came to my own conclusions that this concept of shame is really, like, about the interaction between humans, and it's about ego. It's about me feeling more than or less than by engaging with another person in a comparative way. And so much of my life leading up to, like, you know, like when I was, like, I guess 19 or 20, I was like, I grew up in a very hyper religious background, and then I became an atheist for like a decade. And so what ended up happening as I kind of came into this understanding of, like, my relationship to God is that actually that's the only relationship that really is relevant as far as it comes, as it relates to shame. The only relevant, like, responsibility is my responsibility to God. So my interaction with you, Tiffany, I choose to be respectful. I choose to be loving. I choose to do all the things that I do that are good, that are wholesome, that are healthy, as a responsibility to God, not necessarily to you, right? And if you, Tiffany, ever did something that I found offensive, I would not take it as you trying to offend me, but rather that's something that you're going to have to work out with God later. And so what I started doing by kind of redirecting the way I think about this ego relationship is finding ways to kind of diffuse my feeling of guilt or shame or anything in relationship to, you know, another human being, because really it's actually a bunch of relationships with God. And how do we manage those? How do I respond the best way? And so that's a little bit about where I'm coming from with that.
That's such a real human experience, having to assimilate, having to make transitions. I mean, it can be when you're integrating into a new country or just into a new town where the culture, and I'm using culture in the most vast way, but the culture is different. I think a lot of people can relate to, especially in the States, of course, but I'm sure all around the world can relate to this idea of having to take your identity elsewhere. Again, maybe you've traveled far, but maybe it's just going to a new school, going somewhere new, and having to find a way to maintain not just who you are, but that sense of self and that feeling of, oh, it's okay to be me. It's, and especially as a child, those kinds of major changes or transitions, or just the idea of having to kind of reintegrate, that's such a huge thing to experience at the beginning of your life. And I appreciated the insights that you shared. And the idea of, it's like you're accountable to a higher power. That's essentially what I heard you saying. You're accountable, in your case, you're accountable to God. And that's where your dealings happen. That's where you hold, how you hold yourself accountable for trespasses or, you know, for mistakes. And the idea that it's not so much about another person wronging you, although I'm sure you are an advocate for justice, you know, even in your own personal life. But the idea of taking something personally, that's got to be such a freeing frame of mind. Not easy, I imagine, in every moment, but that's got to be so freeing to just say, you know what? Yeah, maybe this person did me wrong, or maybe they, in the smallest ways or in, you know, more egregious ways, but to have the mindset that, no, it's not really about me. You know, it's something that they're going to have to probably have to deal with on their own, or maybe I will have to somehow be a part of that resolution. But the idea where it's just not really about, it's not really personal.
Right.
That's so hard, but that's so empowering. And I admire that thinking. And then I think back to, you know, you as a young child or any other young child who maybe hasn't acquired that mentality yet or that frame of mind. A lot can really, you know, affect us when we're so young, those painful moments or experiences when we don't know how to process them. So I was just thinking about your young self, and then now, you know, as you've come into yourself as an adult, what that transition of development, of spiritual maturity, that's powerful. And so I just wanted to reflect back to you. I appreciated what you shared. And I wonder for people who don't, maybe are, you know, are atheist, or who just haven't developed a relationship with God or one that feels meaningful to themselves, is there a way that you could offer the same kind of concept to people who maybe don't hold themselves to that higher power, but who want to still do good? Does that make sense what I'm asking?
For sure. And I think it's not required to believe in God per se at all. I just think that, you know, it's much more of an orientation of like, how does the universe work to you? Each individual has to come to an understanding of that. And some people come to a similar, you know, collective understanding, but some people, you know, maintain various ways of kind of seeing, interpreting, and perceiving that. But like, if you believe that there is something larger than you, and that could just be planetary forces or forces of the universe or karma or any number of concepts that are related to the fact that energy kind of interacts in different ways amongst, you know, objects and humans, like, you know, us as a species, we have these interactions with each other. Like, negative energy has a consequence, right? It has a propulsion of sorts, right? Even if, you know, it's something that's like not really easily discernible by the human eye, there's an energy there. There's an energy transfer. And if you're transferring negative energy, which I believe shame to be something that's like inherently, it's like a lack of, you know, it's a lack of something, right? It's a lack of confidence that you're doing it the right way, that you're showing up the way you're supposed to be. It's a lack of clarity, you know, of sorts, because, you know, to some degree, you're questioning whether what you're doing is right in the context of other people's perception of it. So, like, I feel like that negative energy is not helpful or healthy to anybody, regardless of what you believe. It's more, to me, the kind of thing that we would hope to avoid, like you avoid toxic foods. You know, it's like, okay, this is a practice that I do, right? Because I think everyone struggles with something like that, right? Some element of the human experience is going to be a struggle, but it's how then do you figure out, okay, so do I keep interacting with this thing the same way as it comes up, or do I find ways to, like, find a healthy way to let it pass through my system and hopefully not interact with it at all? But I also think that most of the things that we feel shame about are around oppression and colonized concepts. So even if God has nothing to do with the conversation, if you really look at the root of what we're feeling shame about, usually it's things that do with like cultural practices, sexual behavior and engaging, the way that we feel intimate with ourselves and each other, the things that we find fascinating, attractive, and worthy of our time. There are all these different ways where other people might somehow, like consciously or unconsciously, make us feel like we should feel shame about those things. But honestly, those are things that, you know, there's a colonization that's like setting the tone of this is what you should be excited about. This is what you should be engaged in, and what you're engaged in is wrong. So I feel like there's kind of a deconstruction of colonized concepts and systems of oppression that we all live under in some way, shape, or form that we have to kind of start really thinking more consciously about. And does that apply to me? Does it matter? And at the end of the day, if I don't adhere to this, you know, normalized way of thinking about things, does life really change? Am I really am I in a deficit because of, you know, not engaging or adhering to that? And I think that that's something that every individual has to come to. But, you know, I feel like there are consequences for every decision we make, every one of those things that we choose to engage or not engage. And so it's like, that's the way I would kind of talk about it to someone who, you know, just has a different way of believing than necessarily your traditional religious, you know, God relationship.
Okay, that's very useful elaboration, I think, for people who want to reflect on how they see themselves in the world and how they move through and overcome these powerful obstacles. In the work that you do with communities and community building and leadership building, what have you noticed, Oak, in terms of how people are on the path of either healing from the history and the legacy of oppression, and how are people finding ways to embrace their identity, their culture, and not just embrace, but say, hey, I've got something to offer. If we're talking about building community, if we're talking about truly creating neighborhoods and reservations and communities that are thriving, how are people saying, hey, wait a minute. No, this is not how I don't want to participate in this way. This doesn't feel authentic. Let me do the work to really embrace who I am, where I come from, and then also say, and I've got something to contribute that's going to be useful. What have you observed? What have you experienced? Is that a too big of a question?
No, it's a great question. And in fact, you know, you hit something that's really close to my heart and my current experience. So, you know, a number of years ago, I moved to Alaska from North Carolina. And, you know, one of my practices every time, you know, I move is, you know, where are the Black and Brown people at? If for no other reason that I just want to kind of see, like, who are the folks that, you know, are closest to the original inhabitants of this land? Like, who has the oldest narrative of this place? Like, before it was colonized, before it was industrialized, before there was a bunch of buildings set up here, who had a relationship with the land, with its resources, with, you know, the vibe and the spirit before everyone else? And so I always kind of try and look for that, you know, like what are the possible indigenized spaces? When I moved up here, I just found like such a richness here. And also it's a really special time. You know, most indigenous communities throughout the United States and Canada and, you know, all over really have experienced, you know, this philosophy of, you know, and this is an actual term that people use, a phrase, kill the Indian, save the man. For those of you who are not familiar with this, this is the idea that our culture, and, you know, we're talking about pretty much white culture at this point, is what everyone needs. And everything else, your religion, your original, your native tongue, your sacred practices, your ancestral beliefs, every one of those things needs to be essentially eradicated, erased, so that we can save you and you can become the best part of yourself, because you are technically a human. So we're going to, you know, refine you into the best version of human as possible. So, you know, you saw that manifest in a lot of ways. And one of the big ways that, you know, we're hearing about in, you know, the news is the boarding schools and the effects of the boarding schools and how many deaths and murders were associated with these boarding schools, how many families were ripped apart. And Alaska is not unique in that way, where we, you know, it was not untouched. So what I am really pleased to see here in Alaska is there is this like resurgence, and it's fairly recent, like relatively recent, that, you know, folks are like, you know, because right now we have elders who have been through the boarding school era who are, you know, still processing some, you know, many still can't recount what they've experienced because there's so much trauma related to it. And some actually, you know, were even kind of, there are some folks who are from that era who even are still trying to piece together what was so wrong about it. Right. So like, you know, some people were had a perception that, oh, well, they just went to school. That was the best school for them. And that's, you know, like, and it wasn't really well understood from where they were, from where they were coming from, that they were actually like, there was not a choice. And that the choices that were given were like an ultimatum that was like putting a gun to one's head. Either you go to the school or, you know, you lose this or you don't have access to opportunities. And the way that it's framed, the way that it's sold is essentially, you know, not authentic. But you have all this whole generation of elders and folks that who had just gone through all this trauma and gone through all this heartbreak. And, you know, there are some families that didn't know when or if they're going to see their kids again. They, you know, there was no communication or, you know, equitable relationship that would make it possible for them to, you know, assert their own advocacy. So all that is to say, we have this resurgence of folks, you know, like languages that were very close. Like we only have a few elders for some of these languages. Like just recently, some of the last elders who spoke it fluently just passed. And, you know, some of them, you know, like we're seeing the resurgence of languages that were once thought, well, the last elder died at this point, but they're starting to, you know, like put it back together. And so I guess what I'm saying in context of your question is I'm really excited at this like reclamation of one's own, you know, cultural practices, one's own belief system really being validated and spoken proudly. A lot of Native Alaskans had adopted all these, you know, anglicized names and these other names, these government names, and now they're starting to go by their indigenous names a lot more readily. And so you're, you know, and with pride, not just like, oh, my name is such and such. You know, like it's not, it's like, this is my name. And to hear that, to hear that pride, that tone gives me a lot of hope. To go to community gatherings and hearing people singing in their original language in ways that, you know, hadn't really rung out the same way in so long. And to see that what we're seeing is, you know, this solidarity. And it, I mean, some might read it like my Haitian lens is always aggressive. It's like, we're going to take over this thing, you know, like, cause you know, the Haitian people, we just threw the French out and then took over the whole island. Right. But I sense that, my brethren here really have much more of a kind of a gentle, we're loving ourselves. This is what we've always authentically needed to be. We are reclaiming everything that we were meant to be and, you know, moving towards an indigenous future that is envisioned by indigenous people. So that is really one of the things that like is, you know, that calls out to me as a response to this question. And feel free to follow up if you have other questions on that.
Wow. That is very rich answer and so wonderful to hear about what's happening real time on the ground where you're living. I think that what you just described also, it makes me feel hopeful for humanity. In other words, there have been forces, very powerful forces that have stopped peoples from truly being seen and being honored. And what you just described made me think, once the beginning of that process starts for people, whoever they are, wherever they are, to begin to empower themselves, honor themselves, maybe they always have honored themselves, but take it to a different level now, it's a force. That becomes a force. And I hope and I pray that never again will those negative, oppressive, tyrannical forces stop or try to smother the people who have every right to not only live and be a part of the land, but to make contributions, to help communities thrive. And I have this feeling of hope when you were speaking, because I thought, I don't think anything's going to stop this resurgence or this reclamation. Nothing is. I mean, maybe people will try to do that, but I there's just something very profoundly hopeful that I feel about what you just described. And it speaks to the power of community, of empowerment. And when you have a vision about what you want your community to look like and how you want it to thrive, and people are willing to participate, to me, that's where it's all at, you know. And it speaks to a larger, probably global reality, that there are so many trials and struggles and injustices in terms of corruption, in terms of leadership and government, and misrepresentation, misdirection of means. And of course, we all want, most of us, I'm sure, want justice. We want systems to change, to truly change. And sometimes that could be about just allowing systems to disintegrate, and structures, infrastructure, literal, maybe not so literal, to completely crumble and for something new to rebuild. I am on that train for the rebuilding. I don't know what that would look like exactly, but in terms of the idea, I'm in the concept, I'm all behind that. But what moves me and what kind of gets me up every day is the idea of how powerful community building can be. Do we wait for the new systems to build, you know, be rebuilt? And gosh, I don't even know where that would begin, because certain principles have to be, you know, on the table for that to happen. But who knows how long that will be, or even new policy. But the work we all can do, no matter our perceived power, how much of it or how little of it we have, is helping our communities thrive, showing up, offering who we are, what we are. And if everybody does that, that builds something meaningful. And so just reflecting on what you just shared and the power in that process of rebuilding, I think we can't wait for the leaders and for policies before we start to make change. And maybe I'm not saying that's a new idea. I'm not saying I'm the first person. Of course, I'm not the first person to have that idea, but it's just, personally, it's becoming very clear to me that we can't wait in order for real change to happen. Although, of course, I want justice on every level of society. So I don't know if you have anything to say about what I just shared.
For sure. So I definitely have thoughts in regards to, like, thinking about the future and, like, our indigenous future, you know, our authentic futures, and just what it is supposed to be. Because, like, you know, you mentioned a concept that to me has been described as the process of, you know, disintegration and integration of systems, right? Where the old systems that are, you know, toxic and defunct are disintegrating, and they are kind of eating themselves alive, which we're seeing so prevalently throughout so many of our institutions and our communities. And there's a process of integration that we can be engaged in as a community as well, right? As a society, each individual has to kind of find ways to contribute to a larger integration. What do we want this future to look like? And how can we do so in a way that's not waiting for the current institutions to recognize that, to validate that, or to support it, but rather figuring out with the resources at our fingertips, with what's available to us, with what we know from our indigenous knowledge and from our ancestors, and what, you know, is authentically us, how do we move forward in a way that's healthy, that's balanced, that's integrated, where people can be their whole selves? And it's easy to say something like that, right? It's going to require a lot of work on the part of individuals, communities, and institutions to really interact with each other with grace, to learn how to move forward in ways that are authentic, but also are, like, reflective, right? Because, like, there are plenty of people right now who move forward and move in the world confidently, but not wise. And so, you know, a reflection process would really, you know, be necessary for each individual in each community to be like, hey, you know, how are we doing? Is what we did today the right thing? Or, you know, what, how did that go? How could it go better? And like recurringly, right? Every week or so, or every month or so, just being like, okay, cool. How's it going? How did we do? I feel like that is where, you know, a lot of our communities are going to have to go. And it's not going to have, it's not going to be waiting on whether or not the current, you know, governmental institutions are, you know, leading the way, because they're not going to. Like, most of the current systems only benefit from things staying the way they are. And if we've come to the conclusion that things are not adequate the way they are, then we just have to figure out how to change it. And not to like even interact with the old system necessarily. It's really just like, okay, cool. So what do we want to see? Because like, if the government system is failing us anyway, they're not even paying attention. They don't care about us. So we can just do the things that we need to do right here in plain sight, because they're not really, they don't care about how we're doing. They're worried about how much money, how much land, how much this they can possibly grab from this, you know, current, you know, season in their careers. But for us, we've been here for this, you know, we've been here for generations. We're going to be here for generations. And so we actually know what's best for us. And we know ultimately that, you know, based on the principles, the philosophy that we know that, you know, grounds us, that the next steps forward into our future, you know, won't necessarily look like the past, but they'll be informed by our past and be informed by our love of this place, right? It's not transient. It's not something that, you know, takes advantage of the land, you know. One of the conversations here so prevalently is around the resources. Fish is a big deal here. Hunting is a big deal here. So like hunting moose, caribou, you name it. There's a number of things that have to do with, you know, the indigenous ways of life that are like subsistence and, you know, ways that we survive. So, you know, what's a different pace than a lot of other cultures is that here it's like you have a few months of like warm time, right? So like you have summer, you have a little bit of spring, a little bit of fall, but basically you have a certain amount of time to plant things, hunt things, fish, and all this. You fill up your freezer so that you can then survive throughout the course of the rest of the winter. If we were cut off from all resources, if we no longer had a Costco here in Anchorage, Alaska, you know, what are the practices that would actually keep us alive despite the breakdown of systems like that? And that's what I feel is so valuable about the indigenous way of life, because they've been doing this for thousands of years. And so that's, but you know, there's the, but that's something that's under threat by, you know, commercial interests trying to harvest the same resources, but in this larger way, right? In this, you know, exporting salmon, exporting king crab, and, you know, like all these resources that, you know, have been in, you know, indigenous awareness for thousands of years are now part of this industry that is exporting it for this larger commercial interest. And so then there'll be these parallels between, well, why are the, you know, Alaska natives, you know, able to, you know, harvest this and the other? Well, they have principles that guide how much they harvest. They don't harvest more than they need. But you guys over here will repeatedly, y'all are perpetual line steppers. Y'all will, at every possible opportunity, take advantage of, oh, well, the law didn't say I couldn't do that. Like, you know, this kind of mentality. Mm-hmm. Whereas the indigenous approach to it is just like, I have nothing but respect for my land, for the resources, for how much I take, right? You know, like there's a principle in berry picking. You take a certain amount, but you always leave enough for the for more to grow, or for the next person that's coming. You don't just come in and sweep and get everything into your berry bucket. You actually take a certain amount that's reasonable, but like leave in case someone comes behind you and wants berries as well, you know, or so, you know, and for the plants themselves to replenish themselves so they don't get completely, you know, depleted. And these are concepts that most colonized and Western, you know, approaches to like harvesting just don't even take into consideration, because they're just visiting. They're just, you know, they're exploiting the land. They're not, you know, engaging with it in the same meaningful way that indigenous knowledge, you know, suggests.